the circle. In the second place, because he was possessed by a sudden mad hankering after Russia. In the third place, finally, because he regretted those years of youth and everything associated with it. The fierce resentment, the uncouthness, the ardency, and the dazzlingly green mornings when the coppice deafened you with its golden aureoles. As he sat in the cafe and kept diluting with siphoned soda the paling sweetness of his cassis, he recalled the past with a constriction of the heart, with melancholy. And what kind of melancholy? Well, a kind not yet sufficiently investigated. All that distant past rose with his breast, raised by a sigh, and slowly his father ascended from the grave, squaring his shoulders. Ilya Ilyich Bychkov, le maître d'école chez nous au village, in flowing black tie, picturesquely knotted, and pongee jacket, whose buttons began, in the old fashion, high in the breastbone, but stopped also at a high point, letting the diverging coat flaps reveal the watch chain across the waistcoat. His complexion was reddish, his head bald yet covered with a tender down resembling the velvet of a deer's vernal antlers. There were lots of little folds along his cheeks, and a fleshy wart next to the nose, producing the effect of an additional volute described by the fat nostril. In his high school and college days, Inokenti used to travel from town on holidays to visit his father at Lishino. Diving still deeper, he could remember the demolition of the old school at the end of the village, the clearing of the ground for its successor, the foundation stone ceremony, the religious service in the wind. Count Konstantin Gadunov Cherjintsev, throwing the traditional gold coin, the coin sticking edgewise in the clay. The new building was of a grainy granitic gray on its outside, its inside for several years and then for another long spell, that is, when it joined the staff of memory, suddenly smelt of glue. The classes were graced with glossy educational appliances such as enlarged portraits of insects injurious to field or forest. But Inokenti found even more irritating the stuffed birds provided by Godunov Cherjintsev, flirting with the common people. Yes, he saw himself as a stern plebeian. Hatred, or so it seemed, suffocated him when, as a youth, he used to look across the river at the great manorial park, heavy with ancient privileges and imperial grants, casting the reflection of its black amassments onto the green water, with the creamy blur of a racemosa blooming here and there among the fir trees. The new school was built on the threshold of this century, at a time when Godunov Cherjintsev had returned from his fifth expedition to Central Asia and was spending the summer at Lishino, his estate in the government of St. Petersburg, with his young wife. At 40, he was twice as old as she. To what a depth one has plunged, good God! In a melting crystalline mist, as if it were all taking place underwater, Inokenti saw himself as a boy of 3 or 4 entering the manor house and floating through marvelous rooms, with his father moving on tiptoe, a damp nosegay of lilies of the valley bunched in his fist so tight that they squeaked, and everything around seemed moist, too, a luminous, squeaking, quivering haze, which was all one could distinguish. But in later years it turned into a shameful recollection. His father's flowers, tiptoeing progress, and sweating temples, darkly symbolizing grateful servility, especially after Inokenti was told by an old peasant that Ilya Ilyich had been disentangled by our good master from a trivial but tacky political affair for which he would have been banished to the backwoods of the empire had the count not interceded. Tanya used to say that they had relatives not only in the animal kingdom but also among plants and minerals. And indeed, Russian and foreign naturalists had described under the specific name of Godunovi a new pheasant, a new antelope, a new rhododendron, and there was even a whole Godunov range. He himself described only insects. Those discoveries of his outstanding contributions to zoology, and a thousand perils, for disregarding which he was famous, could not, however, make people indulgent to his high descent and great wealth. Furthermore, let us not forget that certain sections of our intelligentsia had always held non-applied scientific research in contempt, and therefore Godunov was rebuked for showing more interest in Sink-Yang bugs than in the plight of the Russian peasant. Young Innocenti readily believed the tales, actually idiotic, told about the Count's traveling concubines, his Chinese-style inhumanity, and the secret errands he discharged for the Tsar, to spite the English. The reality of his image remained dim. An ungloved hand throwing a gold piece, and in the still earlier recollection, that visit to the manor house, the lord of which got confused by the child with a Kalmuk, dressed in sky blue, met on the way through a reception hall. Then Godunov departed again, to Samarkand or Verny, towns from which he usually started his fabulous strolls, and was gone a long time. Meanwhile, his family summered in the south, apparently preferring their Crimean country place to their Petropolitan one. Their winters were spent in the capital. There, on the quay, stood their house, a two-floor private residence painted an olive hue. Innocenti sometimes happened to walk by. His memory retained the feminine forms of a statue, showing its dimpled sugar-white buttock through the patterned gauze on a whole-glassed window. Olive-brown Atlantes, with strongly arched ribs, supported a balcony. The strain of their stone muscles and their agonizingly twisted mouths struck our hot-headed upper-grader as an allegory of the enslaved proletariat. Once or twice on that quay, in the beginning of the gusty Neva spring, he glimpsed the little Godunov girl with her fox terrier and governess. They positively whirled by, yet were so vividly outlined. Tanya wore boots laced up to the knee and a short navy blue coat with knobbed brass buttons, and as she marched rapidly past, she slapped the pleats of her short navy blue skirt. With what? I think with the dog leash she carried, and the Ladoga wind tossed the ribbons of her sailor cap, and a little behind her sped her governess, caracul jacketed, her waist flexed, one arm thrown out, the hand encased in a muff of tight-curled black fur. He lodged at his aunt's, a seamstress in an Akhtar tenement. He was morose, unsociable, applied ponderous groaning efforts to his studies while limiting his ambition to a passing mark, but to everybody's astonishment finished school brilliantly, and at the age of 18 entered St. Petersburg University as a medical student, at which point his father's worship of Godunov Cherdintsev mysteriously increased. He spent one summer as a private tutor with a family in Tver. By May of the following year, 1914, he was back in the village of Lishino, and discovered, not without dismay, that the manor across the river had come alive. More about that river, about its steep bank, about its old bathhouse. This was a wooden structure standing on piles, a stepped path, with a toad on every other step, led down to it, and not everyone could have found the beginning of that clayey descent in the alder thicket at the back of the church. His constant companion in riparian pastimes was Vasily, the blacksmith's son, a youth of indeterminable age. He could not say himself whether he was 15 or a full 20. Sturdily built, ungainly, in skimpy patched trousers, with huge bare feet, dirty carrot in color, and as gloomy in temper as was Innocenti at the time. The pinewood piles cast concertina-shaped reflections that wound and unwound on the water. Gurgling and smacking sounds came from under the rotten planks of the bathhouse. In a round, earth-soiled tin box depicting a horn of plenty, it had once contained cheap fruit drops. Worms wriggled listlessly. Vasily, taking care that the point of the hook would not stick through, pulled a plump segment of worm over it, leaving the rest to hang free. Then seasoned the rascal with sacramental spittle and proceeded to lower the lead-weighted line over the outer railing of the bathhouse. Evening had come. Something resembling a broad fan of violet-pink plumes or an aerial mountain range with lateral spurs spanned the sky, and the bats were already flitting with the overstressed soundlessness and evil speed of membraned beings. The fish had begun to bite, and scorning the use of a rod, simply holding the tensing and jerking line between finger and thumb, Vasily tugged at it ever so slightly to test the solidity of the underwater spasms, and suddenly landed a roach or a gudgeon. Casually, and even with a kind of devil-may-care crackling snap, he would wrench the hook out of the toothless round little mouth and place the frenzied creature, rosy blood oozing from a torn gill, in a glass jar, where already a chivin was swimming, its lower lip stuck out. Angling was especially good in warm, overcast weather when rain, invisible in the air, covered the water with mutually intersecting, widening circles, among which appeared here and there a circle of different origin, with a sudden center. The jump of a fish that vanished at once, or the fall of a leaf that immediately sailed away with the current. And how delicious it was to go bathing beneath that tepid drizzle, on the blending line of two homogeneous but differently shaped elements, the thick river water and the slender celestial one. Innocenti took his dip intelligently, and indulged afterwards in a long rub-down with a towel. The peasant boys, per contra, kept floundering till complete exhaustion, finally shivering with chattering teeth and a turbid snot trail from nostril to lip. They would hop on one foot to pull their pants up to their wet thighs. That summer Innocenti was gloomier than ever, and scarcely spoke to his father, limiting himself to mumbles and hmms. Ilya Ilyich, on his part, experienced an odd embarrassment in his son's presence, mainly because he assumed, with terror and tenderness, that Innocenti lived wholeheartedly in the pure world of the underground, as he had himself at that age. Schoolmaster Beechkoff's room, motes of dust in a slanting sunbeam, lit by that beam, a small table he had made with his own hands, varnishing the top and adorning it with a pyrographic design. On the table, a photograph of his wife in a velvet frame. So young, in such a nice dress, with a little pelerine and a corset belt, charmingly oval-faced, that ovality coincided with the idea of feminine beauty in the 1890s. Next to the photograph, a crystal paperweight, with a mother-of-pearl Crimean view inside, and a cockerel of cloth for wiping pens. And on the wall above, between two casement windows, a portrait of Leo Tolstoy, entirely composed of the text of one of his stories printed in microscopic type. Innocenti slept on a leathern couch in an adjacent smaller chamber. After a long day in the open air, he slept soundly. Sometimes, however, a dream image would take an erotic turn. The force of its thrill would carry him out of the sleep circle, and for several moments he would remain lying as he was, squeamishness preventing him from moving. In the morning he would go to the woods, a medical manual under his arm and both hands thrust under the tasseled cord girding his white Russian blouse. His university cap, worn askew in conformance to left-wing custom, allowed locks of brown hair to fall on his bumpy forehead. His eyebrows were knitted in a permanent frown. He might have been quite good-looking had his lips been less blubbery. Once in the forest, he seated himself on a thick birch bole which had been felled not long before by a thunderstorm, and still quivered with all its leaves from the shock, and smoked, and obstructed with his book the trickle of hurrying ants, or lost himself in dark meditation. A lonely, impressionable, and touchy youth, he felt over keenly the social side of things. He loathed the entire surroundings of the Godunovs' country life, such as their menials. Menials, he repeated, wrinkling his nose in voluptuous disgust. In their number he included the plump chauffeur with his freckles, corduroy livery, orange-brown leggings, and starched collar propping a fold of his russet neck that used to flush purple when, in the carriage shed, he cranked up the no less revolting convertible upholstered in glossy red leather and the senile flunky with gray side whiskers who was employed to bite off the tails of newborn fox terriers, and the English tutor, who could be seen striding across the village, hatless, raincoated, white-trousered, which had the village boys allude wittily to underpants and bareheaded religious processions, and the peasant girls, hired to weed the avenues of the park morning after morning under the supervision of one of the gardeners, a deaf little hunchback in a pink shirt, who, in conclusion, would sweep the sand near the porch with particular zest and ancient devotion. Innocenti, with the book still under his arm, which hindered his crossing his arms, something he would have liked to do, stood leaning against a tree in the park and considered sullenly various items, such as the shiny roof of the white manor house, which was not yet astir. The first time he saw them that summer was in late May, old style, from the top of a hill. A cavalcade appeared on the road curving around its base. Tanya in front, astraddle, boy-like, on a bright bay. Next, Count Godunov Cherdintsev himself, an insignificant-looking person riding an oddly small mouse-gray pacer. Behind them, the breeched Englishman. Then some cousin or other, and coming last, Tanya's brother, a boy of 13 or so, who suddenly spurred his mount, overtook everybody, and dashed up the steep bit to the village, working his elbows jockey fashion. After that, there followed several other chance encounters, and finally... All right, here we go. Ready? On a hot day in mid-June. On a hot day in mid-June, the mowers went swinging along on both sides of the path leading to the manor, and each mower's shirt stuck in alternate rhythm, now to the right shoulder blade, now to the left. "May God assist you," said Ilya Ilyich, in a passerby's traditional salute to men at work. He wore his best hat, a Panama, and carried a bouquet of mauve bog orchids. Innocenti walked alongside in silence, his mouth in circular motion. He was cracking sunflower seeds between his teeth and munching at the same time. They were nearing the manor park. At one end of the tennis court, the deaf pink dwarf gardener, now wearing a workman's apron, soaked a brush in a pail and, bent in two, walked backward as he traced a thick, creamy line on the ground. "May God assist you," said Ilya Ilyich in passing. The table was laid in the main avenue. Russian dappled sunlight played on the tablecloth. The housekeeper, wearing a gorget, her steely hair smoothly combed back, was already in the act of ladling out chocolate which the footmen were serving in dark blue cups. At close range, the count looked his age. There were ashy streaks in his yellowish beard, and wrinkles fanned out from eye to temple. He had placed his foot on the edge of a garden bench and was making a fox terrier jump. The dog jumped not only very high, trying to hap the already wet ball he was holding, but actually contrived, while hanging in midair, to jerk itself still higher by an additional twist of its entire body. Countess Elizaveta Godunov, a tall, rosy woman in a big wavery hat, was coming up from the garden with another lady to whom she was vivaciously talking, and making the Russian two-handed splash gesture of uncertain dismay. Ilya Ilyich stood with his bouquet and bowed. In this vari-colored haze, as perceived by Innocenti, who, despite having briefly rehearsed on the eve an attitude of democratic scorn, was overcome by the greatest embarrassment. There flickered young people, running children, somebody's black shawl embroidered with gaudy poppies, a second fox terrier, and above all, those eyes gliding through shine and shade, those features still indistinct but already threatening him with fatal fascination, the face of Tanya, whose birthday was being fêted. Everybody was now seated. He found himself at the shade end of the long table, at which end convives did not indulge so much in mutual conversation as keep looking, all their heads turned in the same direction, at the brighter end, where there was loud talk and laughter, and a magnificent pink cake with a satiny glaze and 16 candles, and the exclamations of children, and the barking of both dogs that had all but jumped onto the table, while here at this end, The garlands of linden shade linked up people of the meanest rank. Ilya Ilyich, smiling in a sort of daze, an ethereal but ugly damsel whose shyness expressed itself in onion sweat, a decrepit French governess with nasty eyes who held in her lap under the table a tiny invisible creature that now and then emitted a tinkle, and so forth. Innocenti's direct neighbor happened to be the estate steward's brother, a blockhead, a boor, and a stutterer. Innocenti talked to him only because silence would have been worse, so that despite the paralyzing nature of the conversation, he desperately tried to keep it up. Later, however, when he became a frequent visitor and chanced to run into the poor fellow, Innocenti never spoke to him, shunning him as a kind of snare or shameful memory. Rotating in slow descent, the winged fruit of a linden lit on the tablecloth. At the nobility's end, Godunov Cherjintsev raised his voice, speaking across the table to a very old lady in a lacy gown, and as he spoke, encircled with one arm the graceful waist of his daughter, who stood near and kept tossing up a rubber ball on her palm. For quite a time, Innocenti tussled with a luscious morsel of cake that had come to rest beyond the edge of his plate. Finally, following an awkward poke, the damned raspberry stuff rolled and tumbled under the table, where we shall leave it. His father either smiled vacantly or licked his mustache. Somebody asked him to pass the biscuits. He burst into happy laughter and passed them. All at once, right above Innocenti's ear, there came a rapid, gasping voice. Unsmilingly, and still holding that ball, Tanya was asking him to join her and her cousins. All hot and confused, he struggled to rise from the table, pushing against his neighbor in the process of disengaging his right leg from under the shared garden bench. When speaking of her, people exclaimed, "What a pretty girl!" She had light gray eyes, velvet black eyebrows, a largish, pale, tender mouth, sharp incisors, and, when she was unwell or out of humor, one could distinguish the dark little hairs above her lip. She was inordinately fond of all summer games, tennis, badminton, croquet, doing everything deftly, with a kind of charming concentration. And, of course, that was the end of the artless afternoons of fishing with Vasily, who was greatly perplexed by the change, and would pop up in the vicinity of the school toward evening, beckoning Innocenti with a hesitating grin, and holding up at face level a can full of worms. At such moments, Innocenti shuddered inwardly as he sensed his betrayal of the people's cause. Meanwhile, he derived not much joy from the company of his new friends. It so happened that he was not really admitted to the center of their existence, being kept on its green periphery, taking part in open-air amusements, but never being invited into the house. This infuriated him. He longed to be asked for lunch or dinner just to have the pleasure of haughtily refusing, and in general he remained constantly on the alert, sullen, sun-tanned, and shaggy, the muscles of his clenched jaws twitching, and feeling that every word Tanya said to her playmates cast an insulting little shadow in his direction. And, good God, how he hated them all! Her boy cousins, her girlfriends, the frolicsome dogs. Abruptly, everything dimmed in noiseless disorder and vanished, and there he was, in the deep blackness of an August night, sitting on a bench at the bottom of the park and waiting, his breast prickly because of his having stuffed between shirt and skin the note which, as in an old novel, a barefooted little girl had brought him from the manor. The laconic style of the assignation led him to suspect a humiliating, practical joke. Yet he succumbed to the summons, and rightly so. A light crunch of footfalls detached itself from the even rustle of the night. Her arrival, her incoherent speech, her nearness struck him as miraculous. The sudden intimate touch of her cold, nimble fingers amazed his chastity. A huge, rapidly ascending moon burned through the trees, shedding torrents of tears and blindly nuzzling him with salt-tasting lips. Tanya told him that on the following day her mother was taking her to the Crimea, that everything was finished, and, oh, how could he have been so obtuse? Don't go anywhere, Tanya, he pleaded. But a gust of wind drowned his words, and she sobbed even more violently. When she had hurried away, he remained on the bench without moving, listening to the hum in his ears, and presently walked back in the direction of the bridge along the country road that seemed to stir in the dark. And then came the war years, ambulance work, his father's death, and after that a general disintegration of things. But gradually life picked up again, and by 1920 he was already the assistant of Professor Baer at a spa in Bohemia, and 3 or 4 years later worked under the same lung specialist in Savoy, where one day, somewhere near Chamonix, Innocenti happened to meet a young Soviet geologist. They got into conversation, and the latter mentioned that it was here, half a century ago, that Fedchenko, the great explorer of Fergana, had died the death of an ordinary tourist. How strange, the geologist added, that it should always turn out that way. Death gets so used to pursuing fearless men in wild mountains and deserts that it also keeps coming at them in jest, without any special intent to harm, in all other circumstances, and to its own surprise catches them napping. Thus perished Fedchenko, and Savertsev, and Godunov Cherjintsev, as well as many foreigners of classic fame, speak Dumont d'Urville. And after several years more spent in medical research, far from the cares and concerns of political expatriation, Innocenti happened to be in Paris for a few hours for a business interview with a colleague, and was already running downstairs, gloving one hand, when, on one of the landings, a tall, stoop-shouldered lady emerged from the lift, and he had once recognized Countess Elisaveta Godunov-Cherjintsev. "Of course I remember you. How could I not remember?" she said, gazing not at his face but over his shoulder, as if somebody were standing behind him. She had a slight squint. "Well, come in, my dear," she continued, recovering from a momentary trance, and with the point of her shoe turned back a corner of the thick doormat, replete with dust, to get the key. Innocenti entered after her, tormented by the fact that he could not recall what he had been told exactly about the how and the when of her husband's death. And a few moments later Tanya came home, all her features fixed more clearly now by the etching needle of years, with a smaller face and kinder eyes. She immediately lit a cigarette, laughing, and without the least embarrassment recalling that distant summer, while he kept marveling that neither Tanya nor her mother mentioned the dead explorer, and spoke so simply about the past, instead of bursting into the awful sobs that he, a stranger, kept fighting back. Or were those two displaying, perhaps, the self-control peculiar to their class? They were soon joined by a pale, dark-haired little girl about 10 years of age. "This is my daughter. Come here, darling," said Tanya, putting her cigarette butt, now stained with lipstick, into a seashell that served as an ashtray. Then her husband, Ivan Ivanovich Kutaisov, came home, and the Countess, meeting him in the next room, was heard to identify their visitor, in her domestic French brought over from Russia, as Le fille du maître d'école chez nous au village, which reminded Innocenti of Tanya saying once in his presence to a girlfriend of hers, whom she wanted to notice his very shapely hands, Regarde ses mains. And now, listening to the melodious, beautifully idiomatic Russian in which the child replied to Tanya's questions, he caught himself thinking, malevolently and quite absurdly, "Aha! There is no longer the money to teach the kids foreign languages." For it did not occur to him, at that moment, that in those émigré times, in the case of a Paris-born child going to a French school, this Russian language represented the idlest and best luxury. The Lishino topic was falling apart. Tanya, getting it all wrong, insisted that he used to teach her the pre-revolution songs of radical students, such as the one about the despot who feasts in his rich palace hall while destiny's hand has already begun to trace the dread words on the wall. In other words, our first Stin Gazeta, Soviet Wall Gazette, remarked Kutesov, a great wit. Tanya's brother was mentioned. He lived in Berlin, and the Countess started to talk about him. Suddenly, Inokenti grasped a wonderful fact. Nothing is lost. Nothing whatever. Memory accumulates treasures. Stored-up secrets grow in darkness and dust, and one day, a transient visitor at a lending library wants a book that has not once been asked for in 22 years. He got up from his seat, made his adieus, was not detained over effusively. How strange that his knees should be trembling. That was really a shattering experience. He crossed the square, entered a cafe, ordered a drink, briefly rose to remove his own squashed hat from under him. What a dreadful feeling of uneasiness. He felt that way for several reasons. In the first place, because Tanya had remained as enchanting and as invulnerable as she had been in the past.